With the BBC News at 3 o'clock, this is Jason Kay. The charity Age UK says that many care home residents are facing sharp increases in fees because of the costs of dealing with the coronavirus pandemic. It says that people who fund all or part of their care are having to pay at least £100 a week more. Care providers have to spend extra on PPE and recruiting agency workers when their staff have been sick or isolating. The government's expected to announce later today whether it's met its target of testing all residents and staff in elderly care homes in England for COVID-19 by early June. The Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, made the pledge 3 weeks ago. Sancho Berg reports.
Just 2 days ago, several care home providers told the BBC some of their homes were still waiting for COVID-19 tests weeks after requesting them. One provider said testing was miles away from where it should be. But the BBC understands that by the end of today, testing kits will have been sent to almost all English care homes where most residents are over 65 or have dementia. The tests are for everyone living or working in a home, with or without symptoms.
Prince William has revealed that he's become a volunteer counsellor for a mental health charity. He's been trained to answer messages to a helpline called Shout, which allows people to have conversations by text messaging. The Royal Foundation, set up by the Prince and his wife, the Duchess of Cambridge, has donated £3 million to the helpline. Sarah Kendrick from Shout welcomed his support.
We're hugely proud that the Duke is now one of our family of 2,000 crisis volunteers. He has great skills and experience and empathy with people in difficulty, and those are exactly the skills that we need in our crisis volunteers.
The Home Secretary Priti Patel has urged people to avoid gatherings of more than six, including anti-racism protests this weekend. A series of demonstrations are due to be held in protest about the death of the unarmed black man George Floyd in the US city of Minneapolis. The former Speaker of the House of Commons, John Bercow, has told the BBC he's sorry that he hasn't been granted a peerage as is traditional. He's admitted he wouldn't pretend it didn't matter. He said that he'd done his best during his 10 years chairing MPs' debates, but he acknowledged that he had been at the centre of some controversies.
I've obviously made a lot of enemies, and I know that there are people who've got grievances of one sort or another and agendas of their own who think I just don't fit. I'm not the sort of chap who ought to be going to the House of Lords. And, you know, I'll have to let other people make that judgment.
Some film and TV producers are planning to resume work in California from next Friday. Filming around the world was halted in mid-March to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Hollywood studios and unions have proposed a series of safeguards to allow work to resume, including PPE and auditioning behind screens. BBC News at 3 minutes past 3.
Hello and welcome, I'm Matt Everett and this is The First Time, where we speak to some of music's most influential figures about the pivotal first moments and songs that shaped their lives and their careers. You sometimes get tired of describing musicians with phrases like startlingly original or genuinely innovative. It's a bit like calling someone a music legend. It's very rarely true and it's just become something of a cliche. But when it comes to Björk, it's impossible to deny her unique nature as an artist and the constantly evolving style of her music. Björk's career has been as unpredictable as her output. She found international fame in the Sugar Cubes in the mid-80s, but her musical career actually started when she was just 11 years old. Her first album at that age made her a star in her native Iceland. Since then, she found huge international success with her album debut before releasing a string of acclaimed records, immersing herself in dance music, electronica, the avant-garde, pop, film soundtracks and jazz with equal enthusiasm and skill. She's also made some incredible videos, produced some jaw-droppingly ambitious stage shows, and worked with a list of collaborators that includes Tom York, Timbaland, Nelly Hooper and the Kronos Quartet. This year she releases Biophilia, a fully interactive app album, something that illustrates how she's refusing to conform to any preconceived ideas of how music should be presented. For all those reasons, I'm honoured to have her on The First Time. And I started asking Björk, as I ask everyone on the show, when was she first aware of music?
I can't really remember one particular moment, but I do remember record collection in my house. And I guess I was brought up by my mum and my stepdad to cut a really long story short, they were hippies. So there would be this big chunk of vinyl in front of the record player, and they would be renting the apartment with different people all the time. So basically it'd be like a queue at the record player. Well, not literally a queue, but every you would listen to a record and then it would be turned around and then somebody would just be waiting to put the next one on.
Yeah.
So it would never stop. I remember that, and I remember going through the records and looking at the pictures.
Which kind of records do you remember being fascinated by?
Well, I remember checking out the pictures of things like some Frank Zappa covers. Pretty trippy. Yeah, my mama cried.
Watch out where the huskies go, don't you eat that yellow snow. Watch out where the huskies go, don't you eat that yellow snow.
Yeah, that's pretty far out, if you're very small.
And, you know, like Joni Mitchell.
Honey, you turn me on, I'm a radio, I'm a country station, I'm a little bit corny, I'm a wild.
And my stepfather is a guitarist, so there'd be bands like Cream, Jimi Hendrix. This kind of music was in my household.
Have you ever been experienced? Well, I have. Let me prove it to you.
What was the first record that you owned that was yours, belonged to you?
With all this kind of prog music in my house and hippie music or whatever, I rebelled at the age of 7.
Obviously.
And bought Kimono My House with Sparks.
That's a good album.
Which I think my parents thought was strange pop music, you know? So it was kind of silly music, you know? Which I really enjoyed, you know? So that was my rebellion. So I played that album about 5 billion times. Every time it was my turn in the key.
Visually, already, I mean, visually, Sparks were a very strong band, so was that appealing to you early on?
Yeah, both. I loved his voice. You know, I guess it was kind of like a bit, I don't know what it was, quite feminine, I guess, and quite sort of possessed or something. It definitely wasn't like rock and roll.
Enough for the both of us.
Your first album was recorded when you were very, very young, about 11, I believe. Mm-hmm. What do you remember about recording that record?
I remember going in the studio and being introduced to the studio first time, and the engineer, like, recording my voice and playing it backwards, and I was like, oh my God, you know, fast, and I'm the Smurfs and whatever. So these kind of things. And it was mostly grown-ups, you know, well, all grown-ups except me. And so they were like, you know, I was being taught about the microphone and pronouncing lyrics quite clearly and these kind of things. But I mean, Iceland's different, you know. At that time, Reykjavik had 80,000 people, and the album sold, I think, if I remember it right, 5,000 copies. So it went gold or whatever. But I mean, still in Iceland, everybody knows each other anyway. So it's not such a big deal like it would have been if it was here, you know.
You got really into punk music in your teens. Who was the first punk band you fell in love with?
That's a good question, because I mean, I was kind of the youngest. A lot of the people I was hanging out at that time were like 3 or 4 years older than me. And I kind of liked the spirit more of punk and, mm. And the sort of idea of indie labels and DIY and all this kind of stuff. And I wasn't that crazy about the music. Obviously, I would like something like Sushi and the Banshees, but I never owned their albums. I would sort of hear it more in parties. Like, the records I owned and cherished was more like Kate Bush. But I think that Peter Pan's song on her second album.
What is it about that tune?
Not sure. I mean, I wasn't that sharp in English back then. But I just really understood the emotion. It was really sort of feminine and very sort of possessed and emotional and very open. And it wasn't so structured. The structure was more like liquid or something. And I guess I understood in my sort of naive ways that here was a structure that was not square like rock and roll and punk and masculine somehow, but it was more curvy.
It's been such a long week, so much crying.
I'm
I'm Matt Everett, and this is The First Time with my guest today, Björk. That was Kate Bush with In Search of Peter Pan from her second album, 1978's Lionheart. Following her formative punk-edged bands, Björk then went on to form the Sugar Cubes, the group that would eventually introduce her incredible voice to the world. I asked her what the band's first rehearsals were like.
I was in quite a few bands as a teenager, and then I started in 82 in a band called Kukl, which actually had three of us went on to start the Sugar Cubes. Mm-hmm. So in a way, half of the Sugar Cubes had been together for 5 years before. Kukl was an odd band because the punk scene in Iceland had many bands, and then there was this radio show on like the John Peel of Iceland. He was told that he couldn't have a show anymore in Iceland, and everybody was just devastated, and he decided for his last show to pick his favourite members from six favourite bands and start, like, I guess, a punk supergroup.
Cool.
And we rehearsed and wrote a few songs just for this one, because we all loved that. It was our favourite show. Mm-hmm. That had given us all so much. And we then after the show, we decided to stay together. And so I definitely remember those rehearsals. That band was quite cathartic and full-on, yeah, emotionally very dramatic, you know, and we all wore black clothes and we were very sort of dark. And then when we started the Sugar Cubes, I just took all my black garment and took them straight to the Red Cross. It was just like, I'm never going to wear black ever again, which I never did, actually. I remember being in, like, in cafes with my punk friend, and everybody would be black, and then somebody would be wearing, like, red socks, and we'd be like, all looking towards the socks. It's like, what are you doing?
Can't do that.
It was just so dogmatic. It's like, I'm insane. So I just, like, I'm never going to be that dogmatic ever again. You know, I'd done that. So Sugar Cubes were kind of the opposite. They were kind of quite lighthearted, and we were just the most radical thing you could do after a band like that was to be silly.
Go the other way.
Yeah, so we just became very stupid, really. And, well, at least that we thought was stupid, you know. So we started, like, writing pop songs.
Glinglow, 1990, was a jazz record. It's kind of definitely a jazz-influenced thing. When did you start falling for jazz music? Who are the artists that you loved listening to?
I would stay a lot, spend a lot of my time as a child at my grandparents' house, and they listened to jazz, especially my grandfather. And they would introduce me to, like, Ella Fitzgerald and Oscar Peterson and so these kind of things. So it was definitely one of the building blocks of my childhood. But, I mean, at home I was listening to hippie music, and then I went to classical music school from 5 to 15. So I sort of got three angles, I guess. And then when we did the first Sugar Cubes album and got much international attention, and then we went ahead to do that difficult second album. It took us like a year or two to do it because it was just like, we got really hit hard with it. Like, in the, like, wow, like, how did we do this again before we got all this attention? Like, so this jazz guys in Iceland who are like, could be my grandfathers, you know, like the same age as my grandfather, funnily enough. And then I picked, I think, 20 songs in one day. I went to my friend who has an incredible collection of Icelandic jazz music. It's a very, very specific genre.
I'm about to say,
Very specific genre. And I picked 20 songs. We rehearsed them for one day, recorded them in one day, and then mixed it in one day.
Wow.
And I came back to the studio where the Sugar Cubes were working. It's like, okay, let's get something done here. So I always thought it was really flippant for me. It was very, I thought it was just not a joke, but just like that insane five-day side project, you know, that would be forgotten. But funnily enough, in Iceland, that's like my way most sold album there is. So yeah, so basically that's the story of my Glinglow.
Kata Rocka, a track from Björk's 1990 foray into jazz, Glinglow, which was recorded with acclaimed Icelandic jazz group, the Gudmundur Ingólfssonar Trio. I hope I pronounced that right. I probably haven't. 808 states Graham Massey has collaborated with Björk many times over the years and is regarded as one of the people who helped introduce her to the world of electronic music. I asked Björk how they first met.
I was in, you know, indie band, like, for 10 years, I guess. And it was like my favourite people in the universe, but it was not exactly my favourite music. So when I heard about 808 State and Acid House and all this, I was just like, wow, this is me, you know. I'm not indie, I never was, and this kind of thing. And I ended up contacting Graham Massey. He was like, yeah, just come up, you know. So I like, at the time, like, you know, I asked my mum to babysit my son. And then I took the train to Manchester and hooked up with Graham Massey, and they wanted me to sing on their album. And I was just like, okay. And they gave me this song, like, on a Walkman. And I just walked outside in the rain, in Manchester. In the rain, of course.
Of course,
it's Manchester. The theme of the day. And wrote this kind of melody to it. Yeah, and then they took me to, like, clubs, and I saw the whole acid scene. I think it was 89. Yeah, so it was pretty, pretty exciting.
And that was Oops by 808 State, featuring Björk, of course, on vocals from 1991.
BBC Sounds. Yeah.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time, and my guest today, I'm pleased to say, is Björk. And you just heard Human Behaviour, Björk's first international solo hit and the opening track of her 1993 album debut. That album saw her immersing herself in electronic music and a whole new range of influences, and the record became a massive worldwide hit. I asked her if she could remember people's reaction when the record first came out and how she felt about becoming that successful.
Yeah, I remember playing first the songs to my record company, and they thinking, oh, this is really strange music. This is only going to do the third of the Sugar Keeps.
And they were wrong.
And I was like, oh, I don't care. You know, I just have to do it, you know, once in a life, my life or whatever. So when it became as successful as it did, it was a really big surprise to all of us. We were totally not prepared for it. And it was fun, you know, it was quite a ride.
You enjoy it?
It was really fun. And up to, you know, for a certain time, because, I mean, a certain amount of time. And then when I had sort of paparazzi, like, sleeping in my garden, it stopped being fun, you know. And I guess I was lucky enough to have tried that one. I bet everybody wouldn't mind trying that once in a lifetime, you know.
Just for a bit, just for a while.
But then you want to sort of step out of it, you know. And so I felt really lucky that I got to do that. But then in 96, you know, after 3 years of it, it was just a bit much. So I moved away and I'm lucky because I've still been able to just do my music, but I'm not like bothered in the streets and, you know, so I'm sort of right in the middle. So, yeah. So I had a choice. I could step out of it, which a lot of people can't.
Focus on her.
As well as making her feature film debut in Lars von Trier's 2001 movie Dancer in the Dark, Björk also wrote the music for the soundtrack. I asked her what attracted her to her first acting project and what it was like working with such a famously difficult director.
Well, he offered me to write the music and I turned it down because I was busy doing a lot of other things. And then he was very insistent and kept like, right, you know, and I was like, that could be interesting. Then I did the music and to it and thought that would be enough, and that was quite enjoyable. And then he wanted me to act in it as well, and that's when it became a bit much. I did it for the music and I enjoyed doing the music. It's 12 years ago, so last century. It's before, 1999, right? So I listened back to it and I'm glad I wrote that music, you know. And I think people misunderstand a little bit because they think, oh, that made her never want to be in film anymore or whatever because it was so dramatic. Well, the thing is, it's actually the other way around. Like, I never wanted to be in movies, and I had gotten some few offers before, and I just always said, no, like, if I can make all the albums I want to make before I die, you know, I need like 5 lives to do that. So let alone if I start like acting as well, it's a bit... Because the project was of the nature it was, I made an exception and acted in it as well.
It's got I've Seen It All on it, which is the track you did with Tom York, which is just a beautiful, beautiful piece of music. Were you always a big Radiohead fan?
Yeah, I love him as a singer. I guess I'm you know, I have my love-hate relationship with guitar, bass and drums, you know, which at the end of the day is just a taste thing. It's not like it's right or wrong or anything.
So do they do. I think Radiohead have the same love-hate relationship as well.
Yeah, but definitely there's a lot of gorgeous songs they've done. Like, amazing. I mean, he's one of the best singers around. He's incredible.
I've seen it all. I have seen the trees. I have seen the willow leaves dancing in the breeze.
Killed by his best friend and lives that were over before they were spent. I've seen what I was and I know what I'll be. I've seen it all. There is no more to see.
We'll be right back.
a spark. I have seen what I choose, and I've seen what I need, and that is enough to what more would be greed. I see.
The light and the dark, the fake and the smile, just keep in mind you need no more control. You see what you're and you know what you'll be. You see it all, there is enough to see you.
In 2007, Björk released her seventh studio album, Volta, another surprising move forward stylistically. Produced by Timbaland, it's a much more beat-heavy and tribal-sounding work than its predecessors. I asked her about how the collaboration with the R&B and hip-hop producer first came about.
Back in, when I was a teenager, I was listening also to things like Earth, Wind & Fire a lot, and Chaka Khan, and these kind of things, like Quincy Jones stuff, you know. His projects always been curious for me. And then Public Enemy, I was totally obsessed with. I guess that's not R&B, I guess.
No.
I don't know what that is. Yeah, hip-hop, I guess. Radical hip-hop.
Still, to this day, they sound amazing.
Yeah, I think it's pretty... It's like orchestral, like sonically. If you just play it, it's like... You know, it's like Miles Davis album or something. It's really out there. But I mean, Timbaland, he sampled my song Yoka. So he was always... Like, he was sort of interested in me and wanted to work with me. And I was like... Wow, that sounds a bit odd. I mean, really flattered, but I just didn't see it happening. And then by the time I was doing Volta, I was kind of, that album for me was sort of tribal, I guess. So it was just like that tribe and that tribe. And then I had a Chinese beeper player, and there was Kunono One from Congo, and Tumani Diabate from Mali. And so... And me, including being from the Icelandic tribe. So that was sort of the album I contacted Timbaland and say, you up for being a tribe? And yeah, so that it sort of came from that angle, I guess.
That was Björk's track Crystalline from her new album Biophilia. As has been documented extensively, the new album is available on a series of multimedia platforms, including the iPad. And there are bespoke iPad apps for each of the songs. I asked her when she first got the idea for such an ambitious project.
My intention was to simplify things.
Right, hasn't worked then, no? No.
I guess once I started simplifying, it became addictive and I wanted to simplify everything. No, I guess it was just a lot of things that perhaps were out of date that I wanted to sort of update. You know, for example, the electronic music is very often on a grid, like 4-4, you know, and that grid doesn't have to be that rigid. You know, now we have such sophisticated technology. The grid can be, you know, water, or it can be, you know, yeah, the moon pulling the ocean up and down is actually one app. Or it could be, the grid could be a lightning, you know, and or it could be viruses multiplying. So I was like, okay, now we can reunite technology with more organic things, you know, so it's not, electronic music is not cold anymore. So for me, I was like, okay, let's simplify this. There's always been this wall between electronic music and more like organic, tactile,
yeah,
things that
natural,
that, yeah, that, you know, most musicians, when they play a drum or a guitar, it's something you hold in your hands and you squeeze it and you hit it and you don't necessarily decide what you're going to do beforehand. You're just fiddling about and then suddenly there's a song there, you know, and that's always been a bit tricky with electronic music, you know, but now you can. So it sort of started with the touchscreen, trying to break that wall between, and also kind of how I've always seen musicology. You know, for example, a rhythm in a song or a shape of a song, I always connected it somehow with nature. You know, like, okay, this song is sort of like a mountain. The verses, you're in the valley, and on the chorus, you're on the top of a hill. You know, so that you can do, you know, on a touchscreen.
And just finally, we have to get you to pick a song. This will be the final song that gets played out. It could be anything you want. It can be one of yours. It can be something you've loved from your childhood, or at any point, it's the final song we play in the show.
Yeah, how about Willem's Scream with James Blake?
Why do you love that so much?
I don't know, maybe you just feel the effortlessness of the fact that he both programs and produces the songs and also sings and writes the music. So it's just really, in its simplicity, it's very complete somehow. I saw him play a show in New York a few months ago and it was amazing.
Then we shall play that. Thank you very much. It's been lovely to speak to you. Oh.
This is Radio 2 on the BBC Sounds app, on your smart speaker and on 88 to 91 FM.
With the BBC News at 4 o'clock, this is Jason Kay. The charity Age UK is warning that many care home residents have seen a rise in fees of more than £100 a week as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. It says that 200,000 people are being charged more because of the higher costs of running a home during the outbreak. Organisations representing the hospitality industry have warned that most pubs and restaurants couldn't survive if they had to observe social distancing. Next week, the government's expected to publish its guidelines on how pubs, restaurants and hotels in England could reopen. Ian Mitty, who runs a pub near Wigan, is worried.
We can't trade property on 2 metres, it can't be done. A metre is going to be incredibly difficult. From what I've seen, what they look at wanting to do in terms of controlling numbers, having extra staff on the doors, having extra staff on the floor. The balance between profitability and loss in this industry is very tight anyway when you're busy. So when you try and put your costs up and your income down, it makes it unsustainable.
The Home Secretary Priti Patel has appealed for people to avoid gatherings of more than six people this weekend. Anti-racism demonstrations are planned across the UK in response to the death of a black man, George Floyd, at the hands of a white police officer in the US. An activist and city councillor in Cleveland, Ohio, Bashir Jones, hopes that protests in the US might bring about change.
Structural racism is a real thing here in America. Until we dismantle it, there will be other black faces by different names. But I can guarantee you that this is a generation that's a little bit different. Now, I'm not saying we should loot, because looting does not honor the dead. But what I can say, destroying buildings won't do it. We must destroy a system that promotes structural racism.
Tax officials are warning key workers rejoining the NHS during the coronavirus pandemic to avoid what they're calling unscrupulous tax avoidance schemes. They say people who sign up to such schemes could end up with large unexpected tax bills. Anna Meisel reports.
These companies operate, as many other reputable agencies do, by acting as employers for freelance contractors. But HMRC describes them as unscrupulous. It warns officials have successfully challenged similar types of tax avoidance schemes in the past, leaving people with crippling bills. That's meant some people have faced losing their homes and had their financial future ruined. The official advice is not to sign up to these schemes, and if it looks too good to be true, it probably is.
The governor of California has said that film and TV shoots in the state can resume from the 12th of June, subject to the approval of local health officials. It's not clear when filming will be able to resume in Hollywood itself, as Los Angeles has been particularly badly hit by the COVID-19 outbreak. Strict new safety rules are expected to increase the cost of production by up to 20%. And that's the BBC News. It's 3 minutes past four.